chapter 20. Keep in mind, we are in the last week of Jesus on earth. He will be crucified on Friday, and we are about Tuesday in the Passion Week. So Tuesday and Wednesday takes in chapter 20 down through chapter 22 and verse 6. At that point, we arrive on Wednesday, and the events happen very rapidly, running into the trials of Christ that come in the latter chapters, and then we will complete out through the end of chapter 23, which has Jesus in the grave. So we are looking at a big amount of material, and yet it's in a very small point of time. In talking about the week, Luke goes down the events that he recalled, picks out certain ones that are important. And when you come to chapter 20 and verse 21, really as far back as verse 19, clear through the rest of that chapter down to verse 44, you have Luke focusing on a simple theme. And that is, during this last week, the Herodians, the Sadducees, the Pharisees all got together. They were afraid of the crowds, but they thought, there's one way we can get to him. We can make him stumble in what he says. And therefore, we have captioned chapter 20, 19 through verse 40, loaded questions. Because that is exactly what we have involved in this particular passages. And if we want to note the loaded questions, what they are found in verse 22 and in verse 33. And while we may read them to see what they were, we'll need to fill in the background to see what was involved in them. Verse 22 is the first loaded question. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And to that the Lord replies, and may we see to every one of these, the reply is brilliant. And not only is it brilliant, but it is totally disarming. The second question pertains to marriage. And in verse 33, we have the second loaded question. In the resurrection, therefore, which one's wife will she be? For all seven had her as wife. And that will be the second loaded question. And if you're looking at a red letter edition of the Bible, you notice that immediately following those two questions, you have lots of red letters. Because the Lord is responding, he's answering, and he's facing these questions. Notice in verse 40, the total effect, the bottom line of the questions is brought out. Verse 40 reads, "For they did not have courage to question him any longer about anything." And the interesting thing is, while they were completely disarmed with verse 40, he's not through with them. And he will go back to the book of Psalms. He will take the offensive, and he will ask them, how come David talked to Yahweh and called him Lord? Who is this Lord? And the implication, of course, is that the Lord is the Messiah, and he therefore raises that question, leaves them once again in consternation with verse 45 as they are in the corner with their consternation. He then addresses the people and warns them about these leaders. So the anger is built in verse 19. It's rebuilt and brought clear up through to the end of the chapter. So loaded questions is what is involved. Now, we need a little background on that, because Jesus had taught out of two passages. He had built a parable based on Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. And he had built on Psalm 118 and verse 22. And the way he had used both of these passages literally infuriated them. In Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, a critical Old Testament passage, and in that passage, it talks about Israel as God's vineyard. Israel is God's vineyard. And as Isaiah builds on that concept, he points out that as the Lord planted the vineyard, he expected fruit. He expected grapes, but he got nothing. He fertilized, he weeded, he did everything that was necessary for the vineyard, but the vineyard turned out nothing. And his response is given to that. With the parable, you come down then to chapter 20 and verse 9. He began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it out to vine growers, and then you have the sequence of each year he sent someone to collect of his crops. We mentioned last time, if you would take a map, go to northern Galilee, go over to the north shore or up to the north shore, come around on the western shore, you have lots and lots of vineyards owned by foreigners that had native Palestinians to cultivate those vineyards. And the idea is, as you know, speaking to them, that these foreign owners would have, on a yearly basis, they would dispatch a servant or someone to collect what was agreed upon that was to be theirs. If they had agreed with their sharecroppers, we get 50%, you get 50%. It was just a matter, of course, of sending the slave down. The slave collected the 50%, took it back home. In this particular vineyard, they send a servant. They beat the servant. They send a second servant. The servant is beaten. They send a third servant. That servant is beaten. And the landowner says, what shall I do? So he decides, I will send my own beloved son. He does so. The beloved son is beaten and killed. And again, from the perspective that we have on the New Testament, you know what all that means. Throughout the Old Testament, his servants, the prophets, went to Israel over and over and over again. They went to the vineyard. They cultivated the vineyard. They removed rocks from the vineyard. They did everything to make it produce, but it didn't produce. They were killed. Finally, he sends his son, and with the sending of his son, you have the analogy with Jesus. We ought to keep in mind, the Pharisaic leaders knew exactly who he was talking about. And if you go down to chapter 20 and verse 19, there's no question about their understanding that the ones who killed the beloved son in the vineyard means us. The scribes and chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. So it's very clear they understand what is involved. As he concludes the parable before verse 19, he then goes in verse 17, and he quotes from Psalm 118, verse 22, which reads, "The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and on whoever it falls, it will scatter him like dust." And he makes very clear at this point that the builders are the leaders. They understand that. And that the stone is the Son. He is the chief cornerstone. And the whole issue, life or death, is relationship to him. So life or death. Is determined by relationship to the stone or by relationship to Jesus. And as we've read verse 19, they understand what he's saying. And notice, out of that comes verse 19, this rage wherein they are willing to put him to death or desirous to put him to death. And therefore we termed it rage. But because of the strength of the people, we call it impotent rage. It's rage that wants to kill. But at this point, nothing can be done. And the reason that nothing can be done is the popularity of Jesus with the crowds. We reviewed that last time. Luke 7:16, they held him to be a prophet. 3 days ago, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, yes, 3 days ago, you had the triumphal entry. He comes into town with the crowds shouting and yelling, "Hosanna, he's the king of David, the son of David, he's the king of Israel." And the crowds were yelling for him. We also studied that coming out from the city were pilgrims who met him and laid palm leaves in his paths, and therefore he is extremely popular. It was Passover week. And we know whenever we have a Passover week that two things happen. Number one, all Jews, males 12 and over, came down to Jerusalem. Estimates, 2 to 6 million arrived in the city from Galilee, the northern parts. They all arrived. But also, were they not only those who arrived, but Rome also knew that the political aspirations for freedom, the anger at being a subservient state, the anger is going to run high, and therefore not only did the Jews go to Jerusalem for Passover, but so did the Roman army. And the Roman army would add to the population within the city, literally the most cram-packed day of the year or week of the year, with the Roman soldiers, with the Jewish pilgrims, with those that were native to Jerusalem, with those that came with Jesus. And therefore you have these masses, and very practically, the leaders are so enraged that we are ready to kill him, and we must, but we're impotent. And the impotency of them comes down to the fact that in the context here, we are told that had they moved against Jesus, they would have been stoned to death by the people. So picture this last week with the Roman armies there to keep order, with the patriotism of the people that have seen Jesus do miracles, the large masses that had just been added a few days ago when Lazarus was raised from the dead. And that's when the Pharisees come along and they see people that are going after Jesus because of the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead. And they take it and make a remark, which I take it to be a hyperbole. They say, look at it. The whole world has gone after him. And therefore you have this hatred, the intense popularity, the masses that came with Jesus that have been following him for months are here. And therefore you have bedlam. The leaders don't know what to do. They've got to do something. And it is literally bedlam. But I love to call the last week what we should really call it. Utter, total bedlam. Under calm, sovereign control. And the Lord moves every one of these factors into the area of not canceling, but supporting the divine program. Now, these two questions now come up, and notice down at verse 20. Picture them now, they're withdrawing. We cannot kill him, so let's change tactics. They watched him, and that means the head-on attack is over. No more of that. They watched him. Sent spies who pretended to be righteous in order that they might catch him in some statement, so as to deliver him up to the rule and the authority of the governor. Several things are inherent in this verse. Number one, why do they want him to be delivered to the governor, which would be Roman? Answer, only the Romans had the power of capital punishment. So since they want him dead, they've got to get him out of their jurisdiction and into the hands of the Roman government. Second, Matthew adds the fact that in verse 20, when it says they watched him and sent spies, picture the they as the religious leaders that were prominent. Put them over here in this corner of the stage in the background, plant a couple of trees in front of them, and turn down the light so you don't see them. Because they're there only to watch. They send some of their young students in Matthew 22, I think about verse 16, notes the fact that these men who are now in the background send some of their students. So the idea would be send a couple of seminary freshmen. They can feign sincerity. They can ask the questions we won't ask. And they won't be suspect. And so they sent the spies, that is their young students, who pretended to be righteous in order that they might catch him in some statement so they could deliver him up to the rule and the authority of the governor. You couldn't ask a better question than this. Should we pay taxes? Now, can you see there? Jesus is being played between two forces. One, Roman government. Let's begin propounding, for example, that we should not pay taxes to the Internal Revenue Service. Would you like to take that position and teach it and propound it and emphasize it? And you're probably going to find yourself in some trouble. And yet, at the same time, is there anybody out there, as has always been, that's a little bit angry about the taxes you have to pay? I will not ask that as a question. You know the answer to that. So it's a good question, really, for any time. But particular in this particular context, this is going to be the case. What were they referring when they said, shall we pay taxes? The taxes referred to was a word used for the poll tax. And it was taken by the procurator, whoever he might be, from every resident in Judea. In other words, the word that's used here is the word that was used specifically for taxes in this particular jurisdiction, which at this point of time was Judea. We also know a second thing, that the coinage, by the way, it was simply a small silver coin. The interesting thing is we know some things about the small silver coin. For example, we know that, number one, it bore the image of the emperor. His head was on it. And the emperor made claims. He claimed to be sovereign in two areas, politics and religion. And therefore, every time a Jew reached in his pocket and took out that little, well, I happen to have a dime. The little dime is about the right size, only it's not silver. Every time he took out the dime and he looked at it, there was the head of the emperor. And the emperor said, I am sovereign over you, Jewish people. I am sovereign in politics. I am sovereign in religion. And every time they looked at it, they were reminded, you're a slave state. You're subject to Rome, and they hated it. As a matter of fact, they had a rebellion or two. I'll put down one name, Judas of Galilee. Judas of Galilee was so strong that he said, taxation is no better than downright slavery. For example, keep your finger here and look at Acts 5. You just have a quick allusion to the man. Acts 5 and verse 37. Gamaliel is giving a short summary of what are we going to do with these apostles. And he goes back and with, I suppose, an older head, begins to point out, well, here are some of the things that have happened. And my thesis is this. If this thing is of God, you can't fight it. If it's not of God, it will go away. And here's his argument beginning with verse 36. Some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody. And a group of about 400 men joined up with him, and he was slain. And all who followed him were dispersed, and it came to nothing. Second historical incident. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census. Notice the taxation. That was the issue with Judas. In the days of the census, or the taxation, and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered. And we could add from the source of Josephus, a few examples of things that Judas said. But he said, if you're a freedom-loving Jew, you will not pay the tax to Rome. You would rather be a slave than pay taxes. And consequently, you'd had over the image a historical situation. Now, we ought to add one other thing to this. Should we pay taxes was asked very reverentially. This was not a smart mouth thing. This was not folding their arms and saying, all right, should we pay taxes? No way. As a matter of fact, it is asked in the context of one of the most glorious, wonderful things ever said of Jesus. And you come down and see it in verse 21. They questioned him, saying, Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly. In other words, we approach you with reverence, with respect, with honor. We know you speak and teach correctly. We know you're not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Very, very important principle in this particular context, and that is this. It is possible to say the best things from the worst motives. Well, let's put with that. It is possible to give the highest compliment. You teach God's truth. You honor Him. You do not receive men's faces. You lay it out straight. It is possible to give highest compliment with the worst motives. Now, we've got kind of an age range in here, and if you are a little bit younger, this may be rubbing on you a little bit hard. You mean I could be flattered and I give the highest compliment and then stabbed in the back? Well, if you haven't had it happen yet, just put it in your notebook. And I think yous that are laughing are saying, that's right, put it in the notebook, it's going to happen. And this is exactly what takes place here. This is part of the reality about man and man's sin nature and the things that he will do. We might add, by the way, from whom did the highest compliment come? Religious leaders. So we might add then that the highest compliment came from those that you would expect to be giving spiritual leadership, and yet their motives are base and they are the worst type of motives that could possibly be. Now, let's suppose Jesus says, one, pay it. If he says, pay it, then all of these masses of people, devout Jews, are going to be alienated. So if he says, pay it, he will alienate. All devout Jews. And so their thought, you can see what it is. He's got these masses of people after him. Let's ask him a question. And if he says that the Roman tax is to be paid, then he's going to lose his crowd. On the other hand, what if he says, do not pay it? If he says, do not pay it, then he is open for a charge of sedition by the Roman government. So either way, we're really in good shape. Because if he alienates his crowd, that's what we've been afraid of. And we can walk right in. The crowd's not going to bother us because now they're in disagreement with him. We can walk in, we can arrest him, and we can be done with him. And the Passover week from Wednesday on through the Saturday, we can get on with it and everything will be fine. If, on the other hand, he says don't pay it, then we can make a lot of noise. The Roman troops are already dispatched here because they expect this sort of thing. That's why they were there. They were there to put down any kind of opposition or rebellion against the government. And therefore, if he says pay it, we can make a lot of noise about it, bring the Roman soldiers down, they'll take him away, and everything will be fine. So either way, notice, loaded question. Either way, he is going to be in trouble, at least in their eyes. Now, that is followed then by three things that Jesus perceives immediately. First of all, the Lord knows exactly what's going on, the deception. And it is found in 20:23. But he detected their trickery. The word trickery is very interesting. It's the word pan, P-A-N, O-U-R-G-I-A, panurgia. Now, what does that word mean? Break it into its two parts. First of all, pan. Pan, everybody knows because you've heard of Pan American Airlines. Or if you know anything about sports, you are aware of the Pan American Games. Pan means all, or every, or any. Big comprehensive word. Urgia, you recognize that word. It's from the word ergon, and our English word use of that would be, and I always forget, is it electricity that talks about ERGs, erg? It's a unit of power, isn't it? Unit of work. That's literally what it means. Is it a what? General? How many know the term I'm using? We heard the term erg used? Okay. It's a unit of power, and that's certainly what the Greek word is. Power, ability to work, to do. Put the two together. Panurgia was a characteristic that was observed in some people. Willingness to do anything. So the idea then is the readiness to do anything. And in that desperate condition, the Lord observed it. I see what you want, and I understand something else. You will do anything you have to do to get there. Our expressions, dog eat dog. I want to get to that goal. I will walk on anybody, do anything, say anything, make any promises that I need to do. The goal is everything, and I don't care what I have to do to get there. Panurgia, that's the word. I don't care what I have to do to get there. I'm sold on the goal. I will reach the goal, and whatever is called upon for me to get there, I will do it. Put it different. Total lack of ethics, moral standards. I would like to get to that goal, but I won't cheat to get there. This word says, yes, I will. Another says, I want to get to my goal, but I don't want to walk anybody on the way. Panurgia says, I'd be perfectly willing to walk on anybody's face to get anywhere that I want to go. That, to get the thrust of the word, and Jesus perceives that they're loaded and they're driven by the description of the Greek word, panurgia, readiness to do anything to achieve a goal. So verse 23, he detected their willingness to do anything, and he said to them, and here we then begin to move from the deception now to the denarius. Moves from the deception, and he moves to now the denarius. And the first question he says was, bring me one, verse 24, show me a denarius. What do you think, there are two ways people go on this. Why did he say, show me or bring me one? And some say, see, this shows how poverty-stricken Jesus was. He couldn't even reach in his pocket and pull out a denarius to pay taxes with. Some take it a little bit further. What would that say about his disciples? Hey, Peter, give me a denarius. Peter says, huh? I don't have a denarius. I don't have it in my pocket. To give a rough equivalent for it, we know what a denarius is. It was a day's work. If that was the case, then it means whatever an average laborer, and that's the pay level, an average laborer would make per day was a denarius. If that's the case, then Jesus could not even produce a day's wages out of his pocket, and the disciples could not do so either. But if you look at the text, do we know that? We really don't. All we know is that the denarius comes from his opponents, not himself. Now, might it not be, and I think we'll see it as we proceed, that asking them to reach in their pocket and bring it forth would be more advantageous than to just lay one out and show it to them? The point is, you opponents produce the denarius. And perhaps for a forceful lesson, and to me it makes more sense than Jesus being so poverty-stricken, though he was, that they pulled it out of their own pockets, held it in their own hands. And as he points out the lesson, that this can be used by you to purchase, you get advantage from it, therefore you have an obligation to it. And that's the teaching that is going to follow in this particular context. So, first, produce one. Emphasis, you do it. I'm not going to do it. Two, key question, question is this, examine its face. What do you see on it? If that question were asked of me, where's this guy? Roosevelt? Is that right? Okay, Franklin Delano Roosevelt would have to be my answer, and it says liberty on it, and In God We Trust, 1991, and well, you've examined a coin. Let's take a look at theirs. When we take a look at their coins, you have, first of all, the top side, or the obverse side. And on the obverse, instead of seeing Roosevelt, you saw Tiberius Caesar. By the way, Tiberius was the ruler in the time when this incident occurred, and I am taking this off of a real denarius from the first century. They're not rare, but probably few people sitting here have a Tiberian coin in your pocket. Silver coin in your pocket, but they are available. They're not a scarce item as far as archaeology is concerned. That's the obverse. It has a Tiberius head only. However, on the reverse side, obverse the top, reverse the back, it had a picture of him seated on a throne. Now, the interesting thing about his being seated on his throne, that would make him political king. But the interesting thing, if you look at the denarius, not only is he seated on a throne, but he is wearing a priest's garment. This is exactly now what they would have seen as they looked. And they could have described it just as I'm describing it. We said earlier that Tiberius claimed, and the Caesar claimed, to be the sovereign over the state and over religion. And there he is. He's on a throne, so he's a king. He's wearing priestly garments, so he's a priest. So here is the God, King, Priest. And that's what they see. Now, if we would go to the other thing on the throne, on the coin, here you have two pictures. With the pictures was also inscription. And in the interest of accuracy, and I hope not boredom, I'll give you exactly what it said and the characters that were there. And that was what was inscribed on it, which again means nothing to us. I did leave
these characters are the same, except for, notice the V, the G, V, S, T, V, S. The V character is what in English? U. So this is A, U, G, U, S, T, U, S, Augustus. And if you would look then, this was on the obverse side, top side, along with the with his head. So it's his head there, and then this inscription. And if we would translate that, it says, Tiberius Caesar, and then Augustus, I'll abbreviate, Augustus, son, Tiberius Caesar, Augustus, son of, and here are the important words, right here, divine Augustus. It meant Tiberius is deity. On the reverse side, and you may recognize this now, this is the reverse side of the coin, the inscription part. It said PONTIFMAXIM. Pontiff Maxim. Anyone do anything with that? The pontiff, Latin, for highest priest. Not high, highest priest. With the word maxim, maximum. So he is the priest, the pontiff, to the maximum. And what is a pontiff to the maximum? It's priest to the maximum. Or he is the highest priest. And so as they examine, that's what they see on this particular coin. Now, Jesus is going to come across now and say, all of this spells out for you a certain duty. Chapter 20, verse 25, good place to start next hour. Father, we're thankful for your word and your truth, and as Jesus faces this dilemma, should we pay taxes or not, may we understand from the eminent wisdom of his answer, the way he said yes, and the way he also said no. For we ask this in his name. Amen.